Hey, this is Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb, contributing editor of Unlimited Hangout. And today I'm joined by editor-in-chief of Bitcoin Magazine and author of the Bitcoin Dollar, Mark Goodwin, to discuss some of our recent collaborations over the past few months. Those articles, specifically the most recent, which are Tokenized Ink and Debt from Above, both of which can be found at Unlimited Hangout and Bitcoin Magazine, focus on the specifics and generalities of this sweeping global effort to put everything, and yes, I mean everything, on a global unified ledger with unique identifiers in order to enable the new financial system that will launch in earnest well before 2030, but that seems to be the year that a lot of the stuff rotates around. And this new financial system rests on a few pillars. Those include interoperable digital ID, an internet where you're not allowed to be anonymous, there isn't even the illusion of privacy, interoperable digital wallets that enable both public and private sector programmable and surveillable money, in energy and commodities as currency, and another one being the tokenization of real-world assets. And a key component of this system involves the tokenization and securitization of the natural world, which is converting natural resources into tokenized representations of natural capital that can be stored and traded on a global network of interconnected digital wallets and exchanges. Every tree, every stream, reduced to carbon and water credits to be traded in sweeping new markets that are underpinned by mass surveillance, voluntary in name only, and imposed upon the planet under the guise of saving it. However, the tokenization won't stop there. Beyond natural capital, we have social capital, we have human capital, and the plan is to have all of it, even the most mundane, controlled, surveilled, and made tradable through blockchain technology and marketed as salvation, salvation for the planet, the economy, our society. But as we will discuss today, this marketing is all a ruse for a theft and a coup so massive that millions of dollars are being sent precisely on distracting the public from what is being foisted upon us until the time that they believe it will be too late to change it. So Mark and I, in our recent articles, have been picking away at different pieces of the system. And another key unifying theme is the role of debt in this new monetary paradigm and in efforts to sustainably develop the world. The same groups that have used debt to rob, pillage, and economically enslave entire countries are gearing up to do the same, but on a much grander scale, thanks to new technology and the erosion of any policy protections against plunder by the same financial criminals that gave us the financial crises caused by junk bonds, savings and loans collapses in the 80s, the collapse of different currencies in the 1990s, the implosion of the collateral mortgage obligations in 2008. I could go on. The way to defeat them is to systematically destroy the trappings of altruism for planet and people, in which they have cloaked themselves and reveal what they are really doing, sucking us and the planet dry to feed their planetary Ponzi scheme. So without further ado, hi, Mark. Thanks for joining me today to talk about all the stuff we've gotten into recently. How are you doing?
Very well, Whitney. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's great to be here. I love Unlimited Hangout. It's always an honor to be here and work with you guys. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I sort of listed off a few of these pillars of the, you know, financial system that we've been trying to sort of demystify for people. And there's a lot of different places that we could go here, but maybe a good place to start is what I alluded to in talking about the tokenization and securitization of the natural world. We have this relatively recent, I guess you could say, article called Debt from Above, the Carbon Credit Coup. That's the first of a two-part, hope maybe more series, we'll see. So up until this podcast, we've only really done one interview talking about it, and there's a lot we didn't get into in that particular interview, but obviously a lot of ground was covered. So maybe we could just like sort of succinctly, if possible, it is a pretty long piece, but sort of succinctly summarize more or less what's going on here in the context of this broader new financial system that we are trying to pick apart.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think it's like, you know, it's pretty wild. I think the story in general, you know, it has very specific components to it, very specific people, as you mentioned, you know, like people directly in the junk bonds, you know, scandal, or like literally here again, you know, people in the CDO, CMO, popping with like Larry Fink, you know, are here again. But I think with this, with the debt from above piece, you know, it really does, you know, it shows you the formation necessary to actually kind of enable the new financial system and all the different components that you need. There's a component of subnational and regional government, you know, alliances. There's a component of satellite, you know, Earth observation. There's a component of, you know, leveraging the Bitcoin blockchain to be able to actually trade and tokenize and create, you know, carbon credits directly, you know, onto Bitcoin through RSK. And then, of course, there's like the registries, the insurance companies, the people that are actually accrediting these carbon credits and, you know, kind of, you know, allowing the trading and selling of the tokenized versions of these to, you know, to work in these regional and subnational government alliances. So, you know, this is a really great place to start, I think, in trying to explain where they sort of want us to go with the modern, you know, the pillars of the new economy, because it's all there. Everything that, you know, you've been writing about for years, I've been writing about, is really showing up in this, you know, it's a terrible word because it means so much these days, but like in this kind of conspiracy in the literal sense, there's coalition, all these people coming together to build this system. All the pieces are there. So I think it probably makes sense to kind of break it down and look at some of these things. It might make sense to start with the Green Plus program, and we can kind of get to CC35, get to Satellogic, get to RSK. Yeah, do you want to maybe start off with the Green Plus and kind of break down, you know, why that's so important to this, you know, understanding this formation?
Sure. So, yeah, essentially what this article is about, I would guess then, and it's about Green Plus, which is an acronym, but it refers to this program that they're attempting to launch sometime this week, actually, at least as far as scaling it. They've been piloting it for a few years, but, you know, launching it at scale is supposed to turn out this week. So essentially what it's attempting to do is to have various municipalities throughout Latin America, thousands of which have apparently signed on, to, you know, sign these contractual obligations with these groups that are running Green Plus, which is run by this consortium of different groups that are, you know, we break down specifically and talk about specifically in the article. And then those contractual obligations are about these localities handing over essentially their protected areas for to be used to produce basically like farm carbon credits off of them. And the idea is that they will be paid back. They will be disbursed money that these carbon credits generate for the purpose of, you know, conservation and things like that. But specifically, conservation has to be with an approved partner approved by the consortium. And the type of ones they're approving are the ones that are all into this financialization, securitization of nature, these so-called nature-based solutions, these debt for nature swaps, things like that, that are, you know, perpetuating the same thing we're talking about. It's not really conserving anything fundamentally. Or it's about decarbonizing, and decarbonizing has to be done with this particular company that's partnered with other members of the consortium that's trying to build an intercontinental smart grid, you know, for power, like smart meter style stuff. That's continent wide. So it's really a way of building this technocratic system under the guise of we're, you know, protecting the forest and conserving and decarbonizing. You know, those are the words they're using to cloak what, you know, they're actually fundamentally doing, which is building, you know, the grid of this technocratic system they've been trying to build for some time now. And all part, you know, it's all part of this, you know, financial system, as we've discussed, that's built on surveillance and programmability of essentially everything, and allowing everything to be tokenized and traded, you know, essentially as currency, become tradable financial products. So Green Plus is just one indicator of others we could point to as well of how this agenda has advanced relatively quickly. And it's not just being advanced by the left, quote unquote, because there's a lot of right-leaning politicians involved. And of course, as you alluded to a second ago, there's people from the junk bond scandal of the 1980s, from Drexel, Burnham, Lambert, that are involved in Green Plus specifically or in financing it, like Craig Kogut. Yeah, but there's other figures as well that sort of loom over this, like Richard Sandor, the father of carbon trading, who was a senior vice president at Drexel when all of this happened, is also the father of derivatives and financial futures. Not only did he invent carbon credit trading, he also wants to make water a market in the same you know, clean water, a market of the same style, and essentially turn everything into a derivative, which is very crazy, obviously, when you think about it. But, you know, these guys have gotten away with so much. I don't think they really see it as crazy at all to just keep going to the next level. And all they really have left at this point is to do it to the entire world.
Yeah, and put it on. I think the thing that's so interesting about this iteration of it versus all the other ones is, you know, it's the same games, same players, same debt explosion, dollar denomination. But this time there's like a technical advancement. There's some sort of settlement layer, some sort of ledger that upholds a universal state that I think is really important about, you know, it diminishes the costs extremely. For the people trying to kind of, you know, do this debt-based game, you know, because before, if you're using, you know, kind of more traditional-based bond systems, you know, you have to have, you know, bookmakers, you have to have, you know, large financial institutions on either side, you need to have litigators, you know, that are paid, you know, huge hourly wages, you know, basically to uphold. And then, of course, you need governments to kind of be, you know, the enabling environment for these types of like green bonds, green finance, junk bonds, you know, these kind of speculative financial instruments to actually, you know, just to settle. You know, you need all of these players to uphold these instruments. With blockchain, you know, you can mitigate it. You can mitigate those costs to just a couple. In this case, directly with RSK, Rootstock, with this Bitcoin sidechain, to you know, to a couple federated federation members, which essentially is just people picked by, you know, this organization that you know, runs the validators and the nodes. And a lot of these kind of structures, these side chains are sort of built as they're kind of decentralized in name only, and they're kind of, you know, banking off of the goodwill you know, of the distributed model of Bitcoin. I mean, that's why these are sort of, you know, created as, you know, they're used as side chains rather than, you know, maybe on like Ethereum or, you know, some of these other, you know, more obviously known centralized figures. They use Bitcoin because it has the most kind of like sentiment behind it of being this like libertarian anti-state, you know, product of the people, this revolutionary thing, which I think in many ways is arguably true, of course, but, you know, also in a lot of ways, in the same way that it empowers, you know, the unbanked or whatever, you know, it empowers criminals, it empowers military industrial complex agents. So like now we're really starting to see, you know, the PayPal mafia, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Steve Mnuchin, Howie Lutnick of Cantor Fitzgerald, like all these people really leaning into kind of hiding behind Bitcoin as this, you know, libertarian ANCAP movement to actually, you know, basically make right-wing carbon markets and push people towards this green finance, which, you know, you've been writing about for a long time. And a lot of these green finance ghouls are some of the worst of this private-public paradigm.
Yeah, so let's touch on that for a second, the whole idea of public and private. I know we've discussed it a lot on some other interviews we've done to get together, but I don't know if necessarily on this podcast, but I think it's very important for people to understand that the whole idea, you know, like, so like take Larry Fink, for example. Larry Fink was demonized, quote unquote, and is now facing anti-woke backlash because he was considered a quote unquote woke figure for his promotion of ESG. When he was on the WEF Board of Trustees. I'm not sure if he's actually still there or not, but he was a big proponent of carbon markets and all of this stuff. And, you know, while the backlash was happening, you know, a year or two ago, he said something to the effect that you people misunderstand why I do this. It's, you know, it's because of the profits, the returns.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
That I will get. And I think a lot of people don't really understand what the carbon market is. I mean, people think it's, you know, all just climate, you know, on the right anyway. They see it as like climate change alarmism and these are the reasons. But no, actually, a lot of people on the quote unquote right really want carbon markets. And there's a reason that it's a carbon quote unquote market also. And the idea up until this point has been to frame it as a voluntary carbon market. Mm-hmm. But there's obviously going to become a time when it ceases to be voluntary, or it'll be voluntary in name only, not unlike, you know, vaccine passports mm-hmm. and things of that nature. And that's what a lot of this other stuff is too, beyond the carbon market, that is going to be part of this new financial system, the digital wallet, the digital ID. It'll all be this voluntary in name only and decentralized in name only. And they're going to market it to us by making it look like a mix of public and private players all harmoniously, you know, coming together to make this truly decentralized system. But they're really, you know, operating under the same rules. They have the same goals. They are, you know, very interlinked. A lot of these entities, when you look into them, they operate under consortiums, for example, like ID 2020, and being a relatively well-known one, promoting digital ID that was really the product of, you know, Bill Gates and the Rockefeller Foundation, essentially. But argues for interoperable digital ID. Let's have a whole mix of all these different vendors and suppliers of digital ID, but we want them to be interoperable because the goal is to have it all be exportable to the same place. So you get that centralization at the next layer. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the public facing layer makes it seem like it's not all the same thing, to give the illusion of competition.
I think the thing that's so funny too about using blockchain for like decentralized ID systems, and I'm doing air quotes even though I didn't do them, like it's a walled garden acceptance, like where they are accepted, where these identifiers actually, you know, are useful. You know, you still have to have some sort of interoperability with like the DMV of California, or, you know, the bar that you want to get in and show your ID to prove that you're over 21. Yeah, sure, you can do all this cool stuff where you can only show the verified credentials you want to show, and just, you know, show the bar, you know, the doorman at the bar that, okay, you're over 21 without revealing. You know, normally when you give someone your license, right, to get into a bar, you tell them how tall you are. You tell them what color your eyes are. You tell them if you have to wear, you know, glasses to drive. You tell them your home address. You know, there's a lot of like data you're just giving up to some random stranger to get into a bar just to be able to prove you're 21. So digital IDs, you know, have this like selling point of like, well, just the verified credentials you want to show. It's like, well, you still have to have some sort of interoperability with some centralized governance to create that. So the DMV, or the U.S. government passport system, or, you know, some sort of Interpol, or some, you know, there has to be some sort of centralized walled garden for these decentralized blockchain token identifiers to work. You know, it's the idea of kind of decentralizing ID is kind of so ridiculous when, like, the whole point of it, of ID, what even is ID? You know, like there has to be this sort of it's useless in on its own. It has to be, you know, based on, you know, some sort of reputation, which requires some sort of other, you know, consortium of people. So there's so much just whitewashing, but, you know, decentralized washing in a lot of these projects that just don't really make a ton of sense. And as Fink mm-hmm. says, you know, it's about profits over everything. Well, the only thing that's more important to these people and these groups of control than profits are, like, you know, is the data that allows them to force the control. So, yes, there's profits, which is a big part for a lot of these people, of course. Then the other side of it is all the data that it enables and all the surveillance. And you know, that's what these systems really are, you know, they're databases. That's what Bitcoin is. It's a database. That's what all these side chains are. They're pegged databases to Bitcoin that settles its state to Bitcoin. So it's like this really amazing phase shift dialectic where they're pushing it as this, you know, totally like freedom bringing wonderful thing, you know, because we control the node and we control the data. But in reality, you know, it's creating a whole public open database where anybody can access this stuff. And so now we're seeing them, you know, use the blockchain. I think really the majority of Bitcoin's life, you know, you haven't really seen a ton of obvious private public moves. It's really, they kind of just kind of let it grow and let it be its own thing. And now we're in a new paradigm. You know, we're in a post ETF BlackRock world where BlackRock has, you know, what it's like 400,000 Bitcoin now or something. I mean, it's just absurd. The US government has like a million Bitcoin with between the DOJ, between, you know, private companies, you know, buying up a ton of Bitcoin, you know, under, you know, the jurisdictional arm of the US government. You know, this idea that, you know, we're sort of that it's this anti-state thing is just really not true. And then you look at a green plus and you're starting to see this. Not only is it, you know, optimized for the dollarizers, now it's being spread out, you know, through Central and South America through, you know, I think CC35 is named that because of the 35 capital cities, right? So we're seeing like these sub-regional national governments agreeing to, you know, to participate in this carbon market that literally involves Earth observation data from Steve Mnuchin and General Dunford and, you know, the richest man in Argentina, Marcos Galperin. And we're seeing, you know, the dollarize, like the dollarize Inc, basically, you know, move in and use, you know, the blockchain as an enabling environment to like create a really scary surveillance mechanism. Not just about profits, about surveillance.
So I think we should talk on the surveillance aspect of Green Plus, because when I was sort of giving a bird's eye overview of the article, I didn't really talk about Satellogic at all, which is the satellite firm really underpinning it all and what actually led us to find the Green Plus program in the first place, because it's a very spooky company. And I think it also speaks to the importance, like why the mass surveillance agenda is so important to these people from the financial perspective, because it gives them extreme predictability over markets and is risk reduction, among other things. But we can get into that in a second. So Satellogic is the company that's underpinning a lot of this Green Plus stuff. They do the satellite surveillance that's, you know, key to this whole new carbon market model they want to use. And really quick before going deep into Satellogic, I guess, it's worth mentioning how that new model is going to be. So up until this point, the voluntary carbon market, the current state of carbon markets that we're in, have had a lot of problems with adoption. And a lot of people on the left that are worried about climate change, environmental groups have been very critical, not just, you know, people on the right, for example, that don't want anything to do with it at all, but you have people on the left that criticize it for being very grift prone and fraud prone, which it has been. I mean, there's been numerous cases where the main carbon credit certifiers or other entities that are issuing carbon credits or involved in creating them in some capacity have been created completely fraudulent credits that, you know, there's been estimates that, you know, over 90% of the carbon credits in the existing voluntary carbon markets are meaningless, meaning they don't actually offset carbon or reduce carbon in any significant way. You know, it's essentially just a new market being created under, you know, certain metrics, but it doesn't even meet the metrics it says it's meeting. And we're told we have to do this to save the planet, but it doesn't actually do anything to save the planet under its own metrics for existing. It's very insane. So the way they're trying to get around this isn't to stop the fraud and the grift or actually make a solution that works under their own metrics, right? Instead, they want to insure carbon credits and create a new market for the insurance industry. So there's been all these different companies that have popped up, including existing insurance companies as well, obviously getting in on this. And they're a lot of the ways they're responding to this is by making new insurance products. One class of them are called parametric insurance products. And these are being marketed for climate unexpected events. Things like, you know, climate change related events, natural disasters, but also pandemics, for example, things like that. And the idea is, you know, having it pay out at a specific point. And so a lot of the insurance angle of this for carbon credits, moving into that paradigm of carbon credits, it rests heavily on surveilling the area that the carbon credit is being issued from, the trees, essentially.
Right.
Yeah. So Satellogic is providing that service and is surveilling all of the localities that have signed on to this. But the problem is the satellite company Our career is run by career U.S. military contractors. They're teamed up with SpaceX and Palantir, which are the biggest contractors, arguably, in terms of their significance and importance to the intelligence community and to Space Force, which is, essentially what they tried to do in the Reagan administration, the militarization of space. Now we're having that advancing drastically and being linked up with Latin American municipalities through these contracts that they're signing under the guise of Green Plus. They're, Space Force people are essentially getting a foot in the door this way, indirectly, but we know how these guys work, and if they can get in, they'll get in,
Totally.
So let's talk a little bit about Satellogic, who's on the board. You mentioned a few names, but maybe we should spell it out a little more in their significance.
I also just want to say, just to the point of the parametric insurance stuff and a lot of this, the kind of the fraud of, the carbon market gambit so far, I think it's really important also to talk about like why a Satellogic is important in this new paradigm and why that blockchain is important in this new paradigm. And it has to do with settlement. Blockchain is wonderful in when you're using actual Bitcoin, because the settlement is final and there's no way to actually like refund a payment without just generating a new one. You can't claw back a payment when you're using Bitcoin, which is really important for these types of grifts. Because the government can't say, oh, hey, you have a huge fine, you broke the law, you need to give this money back, it was stolen, it was taken. No court can basically say, hey, we're seizing your funds because it was gathered, illicitly, or you took advantage of them. There's no litigator that can revoke a blockchain transaction. And then the other aspect of it too is that, they're called smart contracts, but they're really dumb. They're super dumb. And they only run off of the data that's actually inputted into them. So a company like Satellogic, if you're trying to create these like really fancy green bonds that only pay out coupons, based on, a reduction of a greenhouse gas or, some other, metric, right? Parametric, some other metric that, that the bond issuers agree upon using a smart contract. The data has to actually be fed into the contract. Otherwise, it won't settle. So again, this is a little bit like what you and Star talked about on your AI podcast, that, perhaps some of this is just, an ability to create a man behind the curtain and just blame, oh, well, hey, it's the smart chain, it's the smart contract, it's the blockchain, but really it's like the federated, seven guys in a room that agree on it, right? So there's a little bit of that being played into here. And I think that's important to understand that, yes, I do think Satellogic does have these capabilities. I do think, this idea of remapping the planet, high frequency, high resolution, is a real fear that we should have. But the way that they're framing it, is for this smart contract, feeding of data into these green bonds, into these carbon credit market trading. So that's sort of why Satellogic plays such an important role in these municipalities, regional government agreements. It's because in order to actually uphold a blockchain carbon credit market, you need a lot of data. So that's sort of the primer for this. But yeah, let's get into this board, because it's totally insane. Yeah, I don't know if you want to start and go through it, but we'll start right off at the top. Steve Mnuchin is the chairman. And that's, I think, how we found out about this. I believe you were going through Steve Mnuchin stuff, right? Is
that
right?
His new VC firm,
right,
that he made after leaving the Trump administration. Yeah, I was looking at their investments, because the first investment they made is a company that I've written about a few times. I did a whole series on them actually in early 2020, called Cyber Reason. And I've mentioned them on interviews, probably a few of the ones I did last year, specifically because the reason I got interested in Cyber Reason was because they essentially admit to being an Israeli intelligence front company, and they were simulating with DHS and U.S. police departments and different intelligence agencies, a cyber attack essentially conducted on U.S. elections, like it's the election canceled and martial law declared. And obviously, because we're in election year, that became of renewed interest. But I think it's very interesting that Mnuchin leaves service in the U.S. government and then goes and invests right away in an Israeli front company. And then he's also at the same time attempting to recruit the head of Mossad, Yossi Cohen, to his new VC firm. And he's there with also the Trump's ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, who was like very admittedly just as, you know, immersed in the politics of Israel as the United States in a way that's very uncommon for ambassadors to be, and was criticized as being more on more interested in Israeli political interests than advocating for U.S. interests, I guess, mm-hmm. should be said, mm-hmm. which is important, which isn't that unusual, I guess, in terms of U.S. is Israel politique or whatever. But it is kind of, ironic considering the whole America first mantra of the Trump administration. So Joseph Dunford is another person on the Satellogic board. He was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or, you know, the different branches of the military under the Trump administration. Of course, that's when Space Force was made. And he was recruited to Mnuchin's VC firm after the Trump administration as well. And they are both involved with Cyber Reason at the board level as well. So they're simultaneously on the board of this Israeli intelligence front company as they are with Satellogic.
Yeah, the Trump administration is one of the greatest examples of this private-public, complete dissolving of the delineation between the two. I think specifically with these two guys, it's incredible. But, you know, Mnuchin was obviously a One West partner who was a huge profiteer in the 2008 crisis. When he's, you know, leading the Treasury, he brings in Brian Brooks, who is the former VP of Coinbase, to run the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, who is the first guy to put in a law that says that banks can hold crypto assets and that banks can participate in stablecoin creation. Also, another great point, right on the last days of Trump's administration, he pardoned Michael Milken, who, Craig Kogut was basically the head legal advisor for during that whole junk bond scandal. The reason why I bring up this whole Trump administration stuff with the stable coins and the Brian Brook conversation is, you know, as we get to our third member here on the board, is our boy Howard Lutnick, who is the chairman and CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald, which is the group that holds all of the U.S. treasuries for Tether, which is the largest stablecoin provider and issuer in the world, which has just under $110 billion worth of stablecoins and are one of the biggest purchasers of U.S. treasuries, certainly over the last 18 months. I mean, just gobbling them up. And the government literally needs people to buy these things to service their debt, to service their budget. So you're like already beginning, before we even like get into the rest of them, get into like a lot of stuff about Satellogic, you know, you're just looking at the first three people listed on the board and you're already seeing this crazy, connection with the public sector in a very important way, specifically with the Trump administration, which again, we can connect to Fink, who managed his money beforehand. I mean, there's so many things you can look at here, but like very directly, you know, some of the most important players in the private public, domain of private capital creation and stable coins and blockchain integration with the public private sector are apparent here on this board of a satellite company.
So why are they interested in a satellite company?
Right.
And I think Green Plus makes it pretty clear that there's a big financial play to be had here. It's not just about surveillance. And actually, something Satellogic says in its own marketing material is that historically, a lot of these satellites have been used by militaries, intelligence agencies, and governments. They sell satellites as a service to commercial entities as well. They market mm-hmm. it to specifically banks, insurance companies, all sorts of stuff.
Right.
Because they want to, as they say, democratize surveillance.
Right.
But that's not really like, I mean, that's, I think, kind of a misuse of the word democratize in the way most people think about it.
The word democratize is never used appropriately. It's always used as a...
yeah, I think that's...
And that's something that these ghouls do. It's a total inversion of language. This banking the unbanked thing, you know, we talked about it, I think the first time we ever talked on a pod. And I mean, just this idea, you know, it's really like kind of crypto colonialism, you know, but it's done under this altruistic, you know, greenwash, whitewash, whatever you want to say. And these guys are doing it again. You know, their line is observation is preservation. It's like preservation for what? For, you know, the people that profiteered and made billions and billions, if not trillions of dollars on, you know, these junk bonds exploding, on the 2008 mortgages exploding, on the COVID stimulus policy. I mean, we haven't even talked about it going public and Cantor running the SPAC for them and JP Morgan being the special advisor for Cytologic. I mean, there's just, the ghouls are all abound. But let's continue running through the board.
Well, there's a lot to say, but I don't know if we need to spend time on every board member. I think the first four are enough. But I do want to say before we go any farther, so Cytologic is teamed up with Palantir. They've put Palantir in space. Palantir is Peter Thiel's company. Of course, him being one of the co-founders of PayPal, the other one being Elon Musk, who runs SpaceX, and SpaceX is also partnered with Cytologic. And we have this broader network, which we're going to be talking about more in our next piece of this Debt From Above series, you know, often referred to as the PayPal Mafia, but it's essentially a specific group of Silicon Valley billionaires that openly work together. They're pretty much an open cabal, and they like the term mafia.
they did a photo shoot. Elon Musk was famously not there, but they literally did a photo shoot. I think for Forbes, I might be wrong, maybe Fortune. But they all got together, and, you know, it was like Sopranos era, you know, and they all got together and dressed up, you know, Goodfellas style, just totally. Just so ridiculous.
Cringe.
Yeah, but really leaning into it. Yeah, they like the mafia angle. It's absurd. Yeah,
well, because they are that. And and so these particular guys are working with this other organization that we mentioned a little bit in the first piece, and we'll be talking about more in the second piece, that's called Endeavor. And Endeavor is basically this effort. It's sort of like a startup incubator, and there's a lot of these in Silicon Valley land, but this one isn't really based in Silicon Valley, and it's much bigger than just Silicon Valley. And it has a lot of World Economic Forum affiliations. It's chaired by Edgar Bronfman Jr. And people that are familiar with my work, specifically my book, will know all about the Bronfman family. So no need to dwell there. But also Reid Hoffman, who is a co-founder of LinkedIn, a member of the PayPal Mafia, and also the person in Silicon Valley with the closest relationship of them all to Jeffrey Epstein, is one of the key players here. And he's on the board of Endeavor Global with Edgar Bronfman Jr., but he's also very involved with these the Argentina branch of Endeavor, of which Cytologic is part, but a lot of these other entities that we'll be talking about more are there too. And one of the big, the earliest success story of Endeavor in creating a company is Mercado Libre, which is essentially like the Amazon of Latin America in the same monopolistic sense, of Amazon today. That is exactly, it's a very good analog to what Mercado Libre has become. And it was created by this particular group Endeavor, but the guy in charge, right, is Marcos Galperin, who's become the richest man in Argentina as a result. And he is the person on Cytologic's board after Mnuchin, Dunford, and Lutnick. So you have this particular guy, and why is he important in the context of these other, you know, three men that we've already talked about that are on the board? I'd like to drill down on that for a second, because Mercado Libre is not just a marketplace. It's essentially becoming a bank, a digital bank, and the main digital bank for people that are being economically pillaged right now in places like Argentina, but, you know, also others. But Argentina is probably the one that's like most acute economically right now. And people are being forced to not use the Argentinian peso because it's, you know, so volatile and been so heavily devalued. And so they're the biggest adopters in the world right now of stable coins and other cryptocurrencies. And, you know, Mercado Libre, through Mercado Pago, through its relationships with other groups in the area, like or companies in the area that are the main infrastructure for this market there, Ripio, Mercado Bitcoin in Brazil, they're essentially, you know, running the lion's share of the rails on which this parallel economy that's intentionally being fed by, you know, the heavy devaluation of the Argentinian peso and Javier Milei's quote unquote economic shock therapy in the country being forced to onboard to these systems. And Argentina is essentially becoming the economic beta test for a lot of the stuff that they want to roll out. And in referring to some of those pillars that I set off in the introduction, the idea of having commodities and energy as currency, yes, Argentina is essentially becoming ground zero for that. And there's an effort to make stable coins that are pegged to commodities, specifically Argentinian grain exports. And that has already advanced considerably through a company called AgriTokens, backed by Visa. And you have a significant amount now of farmers in Argentina who are not interacting with the peso at all. They're interacting with these stable coins that they're trading over, you know, rails that either run by, you know, funded by Visa or affiliated with Mercado Pago or Mercado Libre in some capacity. So when you take that combined with, you know, you have the Tether custodian guy there, the treasury guy, and the guy that literally ran the Treasury Department in the U.S. all on the same board of the satellite company trying to impose a carbon market on Latin America. It's crazy stuff. I'll throw it to you, Mark.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's a lot to talk about there with Mercado Libre. But also, you know, just, you know, you mentioned this sort of commodity-backed stablecoin play and kind of this, you know, using grains and you know, growth assets in the literal sense, things that you grow. Again, maybe a lesser important board member, but you do have Bradley Halverson, who's the former group president of Caterpillar, which is one of the biggest agricultural infrastructure and you know, machinists companies in the world, also conveniently on the board, which is sort of interesting. But yeah, I think Mercado Libre is really fascinating because I think, especially you alluded to the PayPal mafia, right? And I think one of the things that people really forget about PayPal is where it got its market share from and where it really captured so much was through its, you know, collaboration with eBay. And for eBay to work as the kind of marketplace that it was, being online, you know, you needed an ability to protect buyers from people that were selling fraudulent goods on eBay, or that were, you know, you needed a strong consumer protection for the buyer. And so eBay offered that in a way that was kind of unprecedented for an online business, even more so than a Visa or a MasterCard or an ACH or any sort of wire transfer. So they combined buyer protection with instant settlement. And that was sort of the, you know, the killer app that, you know, allowed PayPal to really take, like, you know, the huge lion's share of settlement was because of this market. And so you really needed eBay to have PayPal take off. Now PayPal is far beyond, you know, just being eBay's, you know, settlement tool. But I think that's really important in discussing, you know, the proliferation of PayPal. Was Pierre Omidyar and eBay and, you know, a lot of these, you know, the people.
Well, Omidyar now owns PayPal, right?
Exactly. So. Right. Fancy mm-hmm. that. So we're seeing Mercado Libre sort of arrive as not just the Amazon, but also, you know, it has a bit of that eBay vibe as well. So the decision of the market maker of a Marcos Galperin that, you know, has, you know, billions of, you know, I'm not sure directly yet if Mercado Libre has a billion users, but, you know, certainly hundreds of millions, you know, throughout Latin America, throughout Central and South America. And, you know, more or less at the flip of a switch, you know, they can actualize, you know, really quickly, right? Like we saw Venmo, which is a PayPal product now, integrate basically in the back end PayPal stablecoin. Now, you know, the hundreds of millions of people that use Venmo now have access to a stable coin that's operated by Paxos because of a flip of a switch of a you know, controlled group of people. Now that the entire market has access to the stable coin, they now have access to Bitcoin, Ethereum, whatever, all the other things. So, you know, there is sort of this, there's a need for a market to actualize these, you know, if someone wants to circumnavigate the state's power to print money, And that's sort of seemingly what a lot of these people now jumping from the burning ship that is the U.S. dollar system and the U.S. government now buried in over $33 trillion of debt. You know, they're jumping from the burning ship. The rats are leaving and swimming away. You know, well, where do they want to go next? They want to go to, you know, basically, you know, state-free money that uses some sort of commodity-backed thing, which, you know, in this case, you know, is the kind of wheat, grain, real world assets. And now they need to market to get velocity and liquidity for. So Mercado Libre plays a really interesting role. Again, they haven't really done anything yet. They've integrated some blockchain stuff. They've done some messing around with stable coins, but nothing at a super mass level.
Well, sure, but they're very intimately tied up with PayPal, and PayPal has their stable coin, right? And so I think it's pretty clear that as Argentina in particular, as sort of like this testbed for this stuff, advances that way. And with Mercado Libre through Mercado Pago being like one of the main ways that people in Argentina interact with the crypto ecosystem, I mean, as the issues with the Argentinian peso deepen, it's not going to get better under Milei, the peso issue. They're going to onboard people onto these other currencies. I think it's pretty clear that the infrastructure for that, you know, that's what they plan to use.
Exactly. That's the thing that, you know, and that was a big part of the book that I wrote, The Bitcoin Dollar, that's about, it's controlling the on and the off ramps of the infrastructure of a decentralized thing. Then it kind of ceases to be, you know, very, very decentralized or very useful as a decentralized thing. You know, if you control all the on and off ramps of Bitcoin to be dollar denominated, which they basically have done in creating know your customer, AML, you know, anti-money laundering, you know, kind of systems and all the exchanges that have any sort of meaningful volume. You know, you create a system where, you know, the controlling, elites basically get to, you know, kind of utilize Bitcoin, you know, to perpetuate the dollar system. Right. So Mercado Libre is now kind of propping up as the market to basically, you know, bring blockchain and they're in these tokenized assets to the global south, to South America. So it plays an incredibly important part to actually actualize all this stuff. You need users. You need a market. Because these dollar denomination things, these tokenized credits, these, like, they don't work unless people actually are there and have access to them and can use them. I think that it's not a surprise. It seems so crazy to be like, why would a agriculture company machinist guy from Caterpillar, a mark eBay market guy, a treasury holding investment company, a satellite or a war general, and a former secretary of the treasury? Like, why would they all come together and form a company? I mean, it seems kind of crazy until you actually look at the mechanisms. Be like, oh wow, these are all the essential pillars to create this, right?
Well, to be fair, they didn't form Satellogic. They're on the board, and the people that formed it, these are the people they want on their board. And that's great important point when we consider that the people that made Satellogic, Emilio Cargamin and what's his name, Gerardo Ricciarte, I think, something like that. They previously had a company called Core Security Technologies before creating Satellogic, and that was a contractor to DHS, to DARPA, intelligence and U.S. intelligence and U.S. military agencies. They're based out of Argentina, but how much of an Argentinian company are they really? And Satellogic actually relocated from South America to the United States in search of U.S. government contracts and to deepen their SpaceX partnership, specifically with SpaceX having been noted in the Wall Street Journal and other places in recent months for, deepening its connections to U.S. intelligence. And it was already the main contractor for Space Force, which is part of the military, but Space Force is also an intelligence agency. And every intelligence agency uses Palantir, from Peter Thiel. And Palantir, as I've written about before, was created to be the privatized version of the DARPA program, Total Information Awareness, which is literally about surveilling the entire planet from space to like the smallest level technologically possible, and using it, running that through things like predictive analytics to predict events before they happen, including predict pandemics before they happen. And a lot of that rhetoric was around during COVID. And of course, Palantir is managing all of the COVID data for HHS and the United Kingdom. But we've also heard it for terror attacks, which is the ostensible reason that Total Information Awareness was launched. And then when it was about to be shut down, they tried to revive it by renaming it Terrorist Information Awareness. But that's also what, you know, Palantir has gotten into. And they do predictive policing, predicting crime before it happens at the U.S. level and all of that. And actually, during the Trump administration, there was a big effort to prevent mass shootings before they happened by doing predictive analytics on American social media posts. That was the Trump administration's idea. And Bill Barr, attorney general under Trump, legalized pre-crime. So we have to keep in mind here that both sides of the political divide are creating this system and backing this system. And carbon markets, ESG, it's not just a quote unquote Democrat thing. Mm-hmm. All these guys are getting in it and they're using either side of the political divide, whichever one will stick, to get the system in place. You know, the party is irrelevant. They all are taking you to the same place at the end of the day. And I think that's something that's, you know, some of my recent reporting on the effort to create the biometric smart wall on the U.S.-Mexico border, that's been like the Democrats' response to quote unquote building the wall under Trump. And now they're all agreeing, including Trump himself, that that's the wall that needs to happen. But it's the exact same thing that's being implemented essentially in lockstep all over the world as far as biometric entry exit programs go. And it's part of the Sustainable Development Goals UN plan, which was written by bankers, essentially.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
it's the same
these
false
divisions
dichotomy.
Are illusory.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Well, nailed it. Yeah. It's the same way that the red and blue paradigm is pretty useless false dichotomy. The private public is kind of becoming this false dichotomy mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And I think you can see that very clearly in the core security technology. You know, yes, they were NSA, Homeland Security, NASA, DARPA, you know, clients, but they were also Apple and like Cisco and Lockheed Martin. And then I think also to, you know, just to connect this point a little bit more, they were also an Endeavor and Trump entrepreneur from the Endeavor Foundation. Which, you know, there was some interesting connections there with Eduardo Elstein, who was the president of Endeavor Argentina, who's a very ghoulish man. Maybe we can get into later. But then also Cargiman, in between Core Securities and Satellogic, also did a venture called Aconcagua Ventures with Craig Kogut. Again, the Milken Drexel guy who did Pegasus Capital. In their venture ended up being a member of the special projects group at the World Bank, again, to kind of get into this private public bullshit. And then Kogut's Pegasus Capital is a huge founder of CC35.
Funder. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. A huge funder mm-hmm. of CC35.
Yeah. I mean, Craig Kogut's whole thing is that he's rebranded as a green finance guy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these guys have done that too, after they've left their careers in criminal banking. Mark Carney being a really good example. I mean, he's like the UN envoy for climate finance. The fact that the UN would pick someone like Mark Carney to do climate finance is like, should be the biggest indicator of the world that the UN is the enabling environment for global grift. That is what it has become. Mark Carney is the guy that like covered up the laundering of money and the bill, like in millions and millions of dollars for drug cartels that HSBC was doing. He like helped cover that up, has just been a point man for the banking cartel his entire career, head of the Central Bank of England, of Canada, and just one of the worst for sure. And he's the guy that's, you know, authoring and helping plan all of the UN's climate finance objectives, which we're told that those climate finance objectives and programs and whatever that he and his affiliate, Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire, are making under the auspices of the UN. This is the only way to save the planet, because using any other sort of you know, dialectics, no one's going to buy in or on board to this thing at all. We literally have to be told that it's like our salvation from complete doom and destruction to start participating in their market that they have designed to be rigged in their favor, of course, but framed as saving the planet. But really, it's allowing them to, you know, gobble up the planet under the guise of saving it.
Yeah, this is such a good, I think that the hiding behind private sector, public sector, like that horseshit here. One of the things that's so important about why Statologic was set up, why a Palantir is set up, is because when you have strictly public sector businesses, public sector funded businesses, which they are, you know, so many of these things are really, the public sector is the exact same. It is just corporations. They're just, there's different restrictions on what they can do and how they can, you know, who they can actually work with, whose data they can sell. So it actually makes a lot of sense when you look at the restrictions of, you know, I don't know, the Bill of Rights, what that actually restricts governments from doing. You know, it makes sense that, you know, these ghouls would basically move into the private sector, and why a Statologic would move into the private sector featuring all of these former public sector, you know, veterans, that's quite literally veterans in Dunford's case. And it's because, you know, in the same way that we've talked about central bank digital currency sort of being this red herring, because the public sector has a lot more restrictions on what you can do with user data, who you can blacklist. The private sector, you know, there's very little that the private sector has restrictions on about what they can do with customer data, who they can observe and all this. You know, and that's why we're seeing a push for private sector stable coins rather than public sector issued, you know, dollar tokens, because it just gives them so much more, you know, ability to do things. And that's, you know, we were seeing that in Statologic, and seeing that with some of their partners. There's the other, you know, satellite company or kind of laser satellite infrastructure builder. It's also Endeavor funded, fancy enough, but that's Skyloom, that, you know, has worked with, you know, building commercial and military satellites for the Pentagon Space Development Agency. So Endeavor has funded them. Satellogic is working with them. Satellogic is working with Amazon Web Services, which, you know, to stream basically the 50 gigabytes of data that the satellites need, you know, back to Earth. You know, and Amazon Web Services, of course, is one of the CIA contractors, along with like Oracle and, you know, a couple other groups, you know, have gotten these huge, you know, public sector contracts, but they're private sector.
Well, Oracle
companies.
Is the CIA, though.
Right. Well, so is Palantir. So are all of these companies,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It's, but they're framed as not being that. But
exactly.
Like, Oracle was Project Oracle at the CIA, and Larry Ellison went from that to making Oracle the company that is a contractor for the CIA and doing the same type of stuff that Project Oracle at the CIA was set up to do, right? And then, you know, Google has early CIA funding in the beginning, and Palantir, et cetera, et cetera. And we see them as these private companies, and there's been this whole rhetoric that's been put out there in recent years, specifically when it comes to issues of like social media censorship, to treat these private companies as, you know, entirely separate from the government, which is not the case at all. And it's been very useful to them for a variety of reasons of trying to like rein them in for certain things. They get in trouble, they go before Congress, people say, oh, the public sector needs to do more, but our hands are tied, they're private companies. Well, really, you know, again, the public-private division at this point is completely meaningless, and they use it as another divide and conquer, you know, tool. Get people mad at the public sector, say the private sector is the answer. Get people mad at the private sector, say the public sector is the answer, and ping-pong people around just like they ping-pong people between Democrat and Republican. I mean, they're fundamentally related, right? Because Democrats are the ones that are like stronger public sector, and the Republicans are stronger private sector. It's all part of the same ping-pong. You know, having people distracted from what's actually going on all of the time. But essentially, the public and private is fused. If there's a uniparty, I guess you could say there's a uneconomy. I don't know.
Hey, wow. Write it down. Know? That's a good phrase. I haven't heard that one before. That's nice.
Well, I don't know. It's the same kind of idea, right?
Totally.
So if it's one political party, the public and private sector, it's one sector.
Totally. And it's same with, you know, hey, let's take it one step further. It's same with the multipolarity angle, right? I mean, this idea that you know, that there's these, you know, competing huge economies, you know, that have these poles, say in Russia and China and the US and, or, you know, Brazil, you know,
has to be the illusion of competition, right? Like, that's why they need it to look like with digital IDs and digital wallets and whatever, they need to look like there's all these different vendors competing for your business, right? But really, it's all the same digital ID, digital wallet slavery system. And they need to make it look like nation states are competing, but they all agree about the sustainable development goals written by bankers.
Or COVID policy.
Financial paradigm. Well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's all part of the same thing. Fundamentally, there's these global policy pushes on which every nation agrees, not unlike how both political parties in the U.S. agree essentially the same things on foreign wars and Israel and certain things about taxes. And, you know, I mean, the actual differences are relatively meaningless and largely based in the culture war. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so to have it go, you know, beyond that, I mean, they want us, they're entertaining us, essentially. They're distracting us from what they're actually building and what they're actually constructing. And they're hiding behind the guise of this great power competition at various levels. And also behind this veil of altruism. And I think that's particularly interesting in the context of the PayPal mafia and also, you know, the crypto space. So like when FTX collapsed, a lot of people, including myself, looked at Sam Bankman-Fried and his involvement with so-called effective altruism. And that's sort of the philosophical veneer that a lot of these Silicon Valley billionaires hide behind. But it's really a veneer. It's not really about altruism in any sort of actual sense. It's sort of like an elitism that's framed as altruism. And, you know, a lot of the stuff coming out of the UN is also framed in altruistic terms. We're doing this for the good of the planet. We're, you know, and doing this to save the planet, and we're doing this for the poor. But they beta test all these control systems on the poorest and the most vulnerable and have done so repeatedly and helped systematize their them being disenfranchised by powerful private interests that are funding the UN.
Right.
The UN is not a public sector thing. It is a public-private thing, and it is being run by people like Mark Carney and Michael Bloomberg right now. And those people do not care about the underprivileged and the poor. I mean, it's just absurd to think that they would.
It's like we gotta bank the unbanked. It's like, well, who didn't bank them in the first place? You know, like who
now that we
that
have
up?
This global slavery system, we want to forcibly include everyone in. Let's include the unbanked.
You're welcome now. Like, please join us. Now that we need a place to shove $34 trillion of debt. Now that we need the whole world. It's like, join us. Like, now we'll let you in. Now is the appropriate time. I mean, it's just it's
a mess.
It's crazy. And I think also too, you know, there's a reason why there's no coincidences. None of these things are a mistake. That's why we're seeing this push for figures who are very much so controlled and corrupted private sector goblins. But you know, seeing a Trump, seeing a Malay, you know, there's a Bolsonaro. Seeing these figures come that are pushing, this anti-state, anti-deep state. Maybe there's an extreme sense of patriotism still, or something like that. But the actual rhetoric is, you know, hey, you know, yeah, like the Bushes and the Clintons let you down. Obama let you down. Here's Trump, you know, to fix everything. And it's just like he's as corrupted as any of these other people. He's as involved in all of these secret, ghoulish things as any of them, affiliated with Epstein, you know, through and through, much like the PayPal mafia, Elon, Thiel, Hoffman. And now we're seeing this Malay coming out who's literally, campaigned on, getting rid of the central bank and bringing in outside financial interests to dollarize Argentina. And it's being done as this, altruistic angle, but it's like he's selling out the country. He's taking the lithium deposits, selling them to Israel. He's a private sector goblin. And people are cheering it on as he's literally cutting up the country with a chainsaw and selling it. So now that there's this useful phase shift, towards, you know, hey, like the government lost your trust. The CIA is bad and the central bank is bad, but don't blame Palantir. Don't blame PayPal. Don't blame the private sector banks that control the Fed. No. Afuera the central bank. But let the rest of us run and dollarize the global South, under the the dialectic of altruism. So we're like, there's a reason why these TikTok creatures and social media, you know, presidents are coming out that generate this consent, manufacture this consent, you know, for this anti-public sector, you know, rhetoric, like right at this important time, as, you know, blockchain is basically coming into fruition and being accepted and integrated by both the private sector and the public sector that these private sector goblins run and control, like a BlackRock. So like we're seeing a new enabling environment present itself. And it's really important to kind of take a look at that and understand, you know, why now? Why are we getting figures promoted and platformed? Why is Malay speaking at Davos about how much all these people suck, but capitalism is the answer? Because they want capitalism. This is how they actually complete the coup, is to actually circumnavigate the central bank and to circumnavigate the public sector restrictions on what the private sector can do. This is why the head of NPR is now saying, you know, the biggest thing in the way of misinformation is the First Amendment. You know, it's totally insane where we're going with rhetoric, and people are pushing the Overton window so far the other direction that by the time I think the pendulum swings back, like we might be so far gone. And people are really just cheering for this dissolving of, again, I don't like the state. I hate the state. But I also understand who runs the state and who controls it. And it's these private sector people that, you know, that push all the buttons here. And I don't want them to run things. That's meet the new boss, literally same as the old boss. And they're creating surveillance networks, blockchains, dollar tokens, and real world asset commodities on this new enabling environment that's blockchain. It's very concerning.
Yeah, so let me talk about, there's a couple things I want to bring up. I want to bring up Bukele for a second.
Oh, sure.
I want to bring up Ron DeSantis also. Well, I guess I'll start with him. So Ron DeSantis was one of these guys, not unlike Trump, that like went around very publicly saying like no CBDC because it's a threat to human freedom and whatever. But in Florida, he's forcing the adoption of the Florida Smart ID, which is a digital ID product made by Thales, which is like the flagship World Economic Forum strategic partner for digital ID development. I mean, it's just insane. So yeah, so you're going to have the digital ID, I guess it's going to be, you know, framed as freedom, maybe. I don't really know how DeSantis is going to do that, but he's one of those political creatures that framed himself in sort of this new mode of, you know, I'm liberty minded. I'm coming against standing against the tyrannical state and the tyrannical plans. You know, that was he was built up in that way because of his COVID stance to a significant degree. And then making this statement on CBDCs, but here he is implementing digital ID in Florida. And a lot of states have gone quite far ahead on digital ID. In the case of El Salvador, you have them being specifically the mayor of San Salvador, which is the capital, which Bukele used to be mayor of before he became president. The current mayor of San Salvador, Mario Duran, is about to be head of CC35, one of the main Green Plus entities. He's vice president for Central America of it now. And has been, you know, a big promoter and adopter of the specific stuff, and is also overseeing the installation of these like biometric video surveillance systems all over San Salvador that are tied up with this Israeli tech oligarch figure who has an Israeli intelligence background, who happens to be a very close friend of Nayib Bukele. So it's very interesting that someone so closely affiliated with Bukele would be involved in this carbon market style stuff and the climate integration of the Americas, economically integrating the Americas through a carbon market and leading the organization that literally has that as its mission, and not being rebuked by him unless Bukele is down for that stuff too. I mean, it just seems a bit weird. But again, I think, you know, some of the role of Bukele here, you know, regardless of what you think about him, there are some troubling things that have happened there in the sense that a lot of glorification of the military that usually does not end well. And of course, El Salvador is a country that for a long time has had a relatively close relationship with the U.S. military, and a lot of major traumatic violent history that largely caused by the influence of the CIA in there, and like the creation of U.S. intelligence-backed death squads and stuff, not unlike what happened in other countries in Central America in that same period of time. So a lot going on there that to be wary about, for sure. And also, I think, you know, I didn't really know a lot about how El Salvador had implemented its whole approach to Bitcoin until we started sort of researching a bit for this piece. But it seems like a lot of it is running on the rails of Algorand, not so much as Bitcoin. And Algorand, as we note in the piece, basically the person that introduced Michael Milken to cryptocurrency is the person that runs Algorand right now, Stacey Warden, who used to be one of the main Latin American debt vultures for JP Morgan. So is that the kind of, you know, I don't know. It seems like there's a kind of, if that's the case, you know, the things I laid out, you know, it seems like there's definitely been a extreme degree of romanticizing this particular figure. And I think we should ask why that might be.
And the connections with, I mean, specifically, I know you got more to go here, but I mean, you know, just recently they had Howie Lutnick of Satellogic, of Cantor Fitzgerald, who holds the Tether bonds, in the office in El Salvador, taking pictures with the head of Tether, the banking guys for Tether, and you know, Bukele with Howie. And, you know, that's kind of concerning to me. In a lot of ways. And, you know, I understand, I think El Salvador has been a very important thing for a lot of, you know, for, you know, Bitcoin, right? As this kind of the first country, the shot around the world, the first people to legalize it, make it legal tender. Well, they're a dollarized country, one of 66 dollarized countries. And, you know, one of the first things that they did immediately is build a 40,000 person prison. And there's a lot of just very backwards, you know, Bitcoin is this anti-state, you know, freedom-focused technology, anti-dollar, you know, getting out of the dollar homogeny. It's like, well, then why are so many of the people surrounding, you know, the dollar, the Bitcoinization of El Salvador, major players in the dollar system and the prison system? It's very concerning, and I think that it deserves a lot more discussion. And I think that this is something that there's a big issue in the Bitcoin space I can speak of specifically, is that there's a lot of Tether-funded, you know, discourse and media, and a lot of the, you know, major figureheads in the Bitcoin space are literally paid by Tether or heavily involved, you know, investors in Tether. And it does a great disservice to actually being able to discuss some of these things. And, you know, maybe arguably instead of, again, I'm going to get killed for this, but, you know, maybe rather than the Bitcoinization of El Salvador, it was really the Tetherization and the dollarization of El Salvador. And I think that's worth having a discussion about, especially when you look at some of the private companies that went in there, like a Strike, you know, and they're like the way that they integrated it right off the bat, it was with Tether. When they opened up in Argentina, you couldn't even buy Bitcoin. It was just Tether. So there's a lot of things to discuss there with Bukele specifically that are very concerning, that I feel like Bitcoiners really aren't allowed to talk about.
Well, I feel like there's a model. I mean, there's an obvious effort throughout several Latin American countries to replicate what's being referred to as the Bukele model.
Sure.
Specifically as it comes to combating crime. I do not want to say that there was not an insane gang violence crime issue in El Salvador. It was very bad. And there's an obvious reason why people in El Salvador like Bukele so much, is because he ended that.
Totally.
But the problem is those gangs, deeply connected to U.S. intelligence. Did U.S. intelligence want there to be a face shift in El Salvador? Obviously a very traumatized population. Whoever ends that wave of crime and violence that has terrorized them for decades, they are going to love that person.
Sure.
Regardless of who it is and how they do it.
100%. And that's something interesting. You talk to people in South America and they love Bukele across the board, Central America, South America, and they love Tether. You know, it's very interesting. And how much of that is because of controlled
discourse?
Well,
they see it as tools of freedom.
Exactly. Well, right. And then yes. You have, you know, private sector sponsored people like from Peter Thiel and Omidyar, 23andMe, you know, like, you know, some people at the HRF coming out and preaching stable coins an altruistic, you know, means, you know, and instead, you know, really it's, you know, they've onboarded the FBI, the Secret Service, and they're perpetuating the Ponzi scheme that is the U.S. Treasury market across the world.
Well, the head of Tether also said to Nadi that their goal is to expand dollar hegemony. He literally said that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that they want to work with the U.S. government to do that, and onboarded intelligence agencies to its platform.
Exactly.
And now the currency, like in Argentina, is being totally wrecked. I mean, it already was wrecked, but it's being wrecked even more, like even more devalued under Milei. And now people are being forced to either do WorldCoin and give up their Iris for some world coins, right? Which is another Reid Hoffman-backed thing. Or they're going to Tether, or they're going to Circle, USDC. So, you know, who's really benefiting there is that freedom. And what worries about me, so with this Bukele model, you know, I can see it much easier to manufacture consent for that model in countries that are plagued by crime.
Right.
So like Ecuador, for example, is attempting to replicate the Bukele model. But Milei saying, oh, we're going to start building mega prisons us too. You know, the issue in Argentina is not a massive crime crippling everything issue like it has been in recent Ecuador or like historically in El Salvador. They have a poverty problem. And it worries me when you have a guy whose whole cabinet is full of bankers from like JP Morgan and stuff, you know, running most of a significant part of the government. And then you're inviting Larry Fink in, who John Titus gave him the nickname Totalitary Larry, for Larry Fink's statement that the markets love authoritarian dictatorships.
Totally.
And so you have, why are you building mega prisons when your problem isn't that your country is overrun by crime? You're overrun by people, you know, more than 2/3 of the population now, like under the poverty line.
Right.
You're building prisons for poor people.
Yeah. And you're creating an environment for them to be forced to, you know, go to illicit means to be able to make ends meet, which then forces them to become criminals. You're creating situations.
Well, it's either that, or you force them to onboard onto Mercado Libre's coming digital ID system so that they can access Mercado Pago and use the state-defined crypto rails, you know?
It's concerning. And that's what I think is very concerning about the Green Plus CC35 element, you know, is that there's so many regional and municipalities that are already connected with this. And it seems like there's not a lot of awareness about who these players are, you know, and again, some of it is speculation on our part, but some of it is not. I mean, some of these things, you know, for whatever reason, these people love to get up there and talk. I mean, as you said, you know, to Howie Lutnick, you know, he went out at the Chain Analysis conference, you know, a week and a half ago, which is hilarious. Which is a, you know, private sector intelligence agency for blockchain analysis. And he came out and said, yeah, I want to extend dollar hegemon, you know, using stable coins and how it's essential for the dollar to continue and yada, yada. These people say these things out loud. So, there's some speculation on our part to some degree, but really it's we're using their words, right? I mean, this is open source intelligence source stuff, right? We're using everything in the public sector. Or just in the public domain, rather. And, you know, there's been a lot of comments. I mean, we haven't even really gotten into the RSK component, the rootstock component. But this Diego guy, you know, basically came out and said, you know, Bitcoiners need to basically strip their, you know, anti-state ethos and their revolutionary ethos and embrace the state. And we've seen that being pushed from every angle. You know, kind of in this new adoption, you know, of Bitcoin by Larry Fink, by, you know, these huge players, you know, there's a manufactured and constructed effort to dissolve the revolutionary ethos that was so useful for them in the beginning of perpetuating blockchain, that now it's no longer useful for them. And now it's this this mechanism and this digital ledger, you know, that is so helpful for them for actualizing being the enabling environment. It's no longer very useful to perpetuate, you know, this idea of it as a currency, this idea of it as a freedom, you know, censorship resistant money.
Technology for asset storage.
Exactly.
And that's what it is.
Right. And again,
that's what Larry Fink says. That's what Jeffrey Epstein said.
Exactly. Hmm. It's very interesting. And obviously Epstein is super connected with a lot of, you know, the PayPal mafia and, you know, and the Bronfmans and, you know, the people that are, you know, running Endeavor, the people that are connected to all these things. There's beginning to be kind of this coalition forming. You know, we've joked that, you know, that our books are basically merging into this horrible thing here of one nation under Bitcoin dollar. And this is sort of, it's kind of happening. But again, I think it's really important to like, look at what they're actually saying. And you look at these quotes and the things that they say, I mean, they're basically calling for, you know, to drop the revolutionary aspect of this and to lean into this capitalism is freedom. And I'm not an anti-capitalist. I think free markets are important, but like not when they're not free markets, not when their markets and infrastructures and the rails are held.
It's crony capitalism, right?
It's crony capitalism. Yeah, sure. You could say the junk bond scandal of the 80s and the saving and loan scandal is free market capitalism, but like who gets hurt? Like the taxpayers that have no idea. You could say that the 2008 crisis, which Epstein is connected in, he was connected in the savings and loan scandal too. And you could say that, you know, that's free market capitalism, baby. Like, what's wrong with that? Isn't that what we want? Well, no, not necessarily. You know, not when you create and you dissolve regulation like a Glass-Steagall that, you know, prevents, you know, taxpayer-backed financial institutions from speculating in certain derivative markets that, you know, they weren't really supposed to be able to with taxpayer-backed funds. And now that they are, now they're too big to fail. We're merging Citi, you know, Citi is becoming this way too big to fail entity. JP Morgan, way too big to fail. Bank of America, way too big to fail. We have to bail them all out. You know, the capitalism has run amiss with goblins and ghouls, and you know, it's not this just like perfect you know, ideology that has no issues. And I'm not anti-capitalist, I'm not, you know, any of these things that people are going to label me as after saying this, but it's like I think that there is a reason why we are getting fed public figures like a Trump, like a Malay, while we're seeing people in the UFC doing interviews with Joe Rogan saying I fucking love private property. Read the Austrian School of Economics. It's just, it's like, it's such a clown show. And if you can't like kind of see the dialectics that's happening here, I'm not saying don't read, you know, Hayek, like do it. It's great. There's some great stuff in there. But it's useful for them right now. It's a useful dialectic to push as they pillage the public, the remains of the public sector.
I do also want to say that a lot of Latin American military dictatorships in the 1980s acted like they were really into Austrian economics and like held up those ideals. But if you look at, so, you know, obviously I live in Chile, I know a decent amount about Pinochet. So like Pinochet had like the Chicago Boys, as they're known, come in, like the students of Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago come in and basically design Chile's economy. And people say that's why Chile's been so stable, but really Chile has been like an economic testbed for a lot of stuff and testbeds for other things for a very long time. And it's been useful for them to have that one like one stable country in South America for a variety of reasons, probably a big part of it being like all the lithium and copper is here, but I digress. But anyway, if you look at a lot of the stuff that's come out in the years since, you know, Pinochet was like a very corrupt guy, had like all these insane bank accounts and weird shadow banking stuff was going on with the Chilean state. Like they were obviously like masking what they were doing as being like, oh yeah, we're all, you know, it's the free market this and free market that. But it was like definitely an insane amount of crony capitalism was happening. And there was like a crystallization of the oligarch class that helped finance and create the coup. In 1973, you know, you have people like Augustine Edwards being like one of the point men for the coup with the CIA. And he's the guy that, you know, ran Banco de Chile, like one of the biggest banks here. And a lot of other, you know, one of the biggest newspaper. I mean, he's an oligarch family, and the other oligarch families besides the Edwards were like that benefited from that period are still very much in control of Chile and have been for a long time. So it's not like that's the free market when you have like an unelected oligarchy that still essentially controls everything. And if there's been this model that's been enacted all over the world. I mean, we also saw it like under Larry Summers and Robert Rubin with Russia, right? And the after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was the king making the selection essentially of all these different oligarchs that were put in charge of key industries during the quote unquote raping of Russia and the pillaging of its economic resources under like Boris Yeltsin and you know, beyond that to an extent, but it was definitely most acute, you know, during that initial period. And that was framed as, oh, the free market is here to Russia. But was that the free market? Absolutely not. That was like Larry Summers crony capitalism madness on steroids, yeah. With all these Harvard economists claiming that they're, you know, going to bring the free market to the former Soviet Union and yada, yada, yada. And they make this insane oligarch class that now is their like sworn enemy, the Russian oligarchs, they yell on like Rachel Maddow's show and stuff. You literally created that, you asshole.
Yeah. And what did those same players do? You know, at the, you know, again, everyone talks about, you know, Brazil and Argentina and El Salvador, but like, I mean, Mexico, you know, what happened in NAFTA, you know, under these similar regimes? You know, why is Epstein visiting the Clinton White House, you know, a dozen plus times, you know, in the early mid 90s? And then why are we seeing kind of this, you know, George Sorosian, you know, this Joe Lewis guy, very connected with Argentina and with Tether. He does the banking for Tether with Deltek. You know, he rode the Mexican peso all the way down and made billions of dollars, you know. You know, and then, you know, we see Robert Rubin jump ship from the public sector to Citi, which basically, you know, privatized or took over rather the biggest bank in Mexico after NAFTA basically did, you know, a similar sort of, you know, altruistic framing. Hey, let's trade with the U.S. Let's do this agricultural trade, all this stuff. And we ended up kind of just destroying the peso in the process. And these guys make billions of dollars off it. These guys get huge cushy jobs. They jump back and forth between the private and public sector. It's Larry Summers. It's Robert Rubin. It's Citi. It's Joe Lewis. You know, it's absurd. But it's done under this guise of kind of like, oh, we're opening up the, you know, the market. You know, we're opening up, you know, these industries. We're bringing the dollar there. You know, same thing, the same players, you know, 7-8 years before, you know, doing the Plaza Accord, which was like kind of the first ever like noticeable coordinated central banking. And they're meeting in the, you know, Roy Cohn's old hideout at the Plaza Hotel. And they're bringing, you know, the heads of the central banks of the G5 at the time and agreeing to devalue the dollar 50%, which is seen as this. Oh, like that's so great that the dollar is so strong and now we're going to help all these other countries. But no, I mean, they opened up all these other countries for us to get in there, like Japan, you know, and to open up the country that's industrializing. So there's all these like dialectics that are done in the private public sector. People come in like a Greenspan, right? He's working at JP Morgan. He writes this pamphlet about rethinking Glass-Steagall, which is the regulation put in 33 by FDR that doesn't, you know, let, you know, banks basically be insurance brokers and do certain derivative trades and be in certain markets and mortgages, you know, in interstate lines. And so he comes in, he writes a pamphlet and says, you know, let's rethink Glass-Steagall, let's dissolve it. And then, of course, comes in, you know, and is working at the Fed, and you know, they dissolved Glass-Steagall in the late 90s, and we have 2008 basically happen immediately after that. So it's like whenever it's useful for them to push the free market and get their people in place there, it's useful for them. Whenever it's not, it's not. But I think right now we're at like the biggest time. Bigger than Glass-Steagall.
One second. So like the Treasury Secretary, right? So it was Robert Rubin, Goldman Sachs.
Sure.
And then Rubin gives it to his boy, his deputy Larry. And then who becomes head of the Treasury in the leap from, you know, to when 08's happening? It's Henry Paulson.
Right.
Goldman Sachs.
Right.
I forget where Tim Geithner was before, but he was under, he worked for Summers and Rubin and then went to Warburg Pincus and then Mnuchin. Didn't his dad like basically run Goldman Sachs right?
I'm not sure, but very possible.
But anyway, I mean, they're all from the same criminal banks, the people that run Treasury, and they, like, it's an insane revolving door. And, like, people just forget that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, they're like, oh, that guy was such a bad Treasury secretary. But, you know, the bank he was front running is fine, you know, it's private sector.
Yeah. Yep.
It doesn't really work like that, guys, you know.
And now we're having the digitalization of it. I mean, things move so much faster. The you know, people love to push a lot of these, you know, questionably, you know, these figures in Bitcoin, right? Like, to push Bitcoin as sort of like digital real estate and not digital currency, like the sailors of the world. Epstein said the exact same thing, basically, in his kind of one known interview about Bitcoin. But, you know, there's sort of a land grab in the digital world, and things move so fast there. And this idea of, you know, the thing that is interesting about Bitcoin is that it's basically digital credit, whereas everything else is digital debt. The dollar is a debt instrument, the way that it's structured. It's to settle debts. And Bitcoin really, it has a debt element to it in the real world that uses energy. Like, you acquire a debt to mine Bitcoin. And then if you win, it's issued to you. In that debt that you incurred from a digital loss or from an electrical loss, an energy loss, you know, it gets transmuted into a token that's, you know, credit, that's digital credit. It's the only digital credit that exists. Everything else is digital debt. And so it's very interesting that, you know, at the time, and again, I'm not trying to say too much about where I think Bitcoin came from, but I do think it's interesting that Bitcoin basically popped up. You know, the white paper is released Halloween 2008, you know, at the peak of kind of the U.S., you know, beginning to realize that the money is getting away from ourselves and we're going to have to service this debt in this way that's very unsustainable. And, you know, we talked about this a bit last time I was on here, but, you know, the Bitcoin's, you know, basically growth in perpetuation with the growth of the U.S. debt is very interesting to me. And I don't think it's a coincidence. And again, Bitcoin is whatever you think it is. I mean, it is that thing. It's a very important technological tool that can empower a government as much as it can empower an individual. And I think we're seeing it, you know, empower the U.S. government and the U.S. dollar market. And so as digital debt is created via dollar tokens, you know, digital credit is being appreciated. And we're seeing rapid increases in Bitcoin's growth. You know, since the ETF, you know, I think Bitcoin's up like 50% or something just this year. The same people in 2008 that saw the debt CDO explosion, you know, these very guys are now actually very heavily connected to Bitcoin. Like a Larry Summers being on the board, we haven't even talked about him yet, but of Zappo, of Wences Casares's company, alongside DHawk, and Avisa and John Reed of Citi, you know, the three of them were the founding board of Zappo, which is an Endeavor connected, you know, South American, you know, the Fort Knox of Bitcoin, which directly is saying that it's connecting U.S. dollars to stable coins to Bitcoin. And that's what it's doing. These same players are basically using Bitcoin as this demand and elastic digital credit to print eventually, as Walter Hessert said to me, who's the head of strategy at Paxos, which is a, you know, a PayPal affiliate who runs their stable coin, that, you know, they're planning on there being trillions of dollars of highly regulated stable coins coming. What does that mean? That means trillions of dollars of debt was printed. In order to create these dollar stable coins, you need digital debt. So treasuries are happening to create these digital tokens. Where does that go? It can flow into Bitcoin, basically be this heat sink. So rather than the economic hegemon leave the U.S. and go to a China, go to a BRICS sort of situation, or just, you know, make gold much more valuable, instead it will basically flow into Bitcoin and be used as this debt heat sink, you know, to expand digital credit. So that's kind of where we're at. I mean, we're seeing, you know, all of these systems pop up. Well, how do you actually facilitate that? How do you quantitatively ease in a super high debt environment, you have to get really creative and you have to basically create these new debt instruments like green finance. I believe you were the one that showed me, I'll let you spill the alpha, but what was the new VP of RFK's campaign? What was her thesis at Stanford?
Well, I don't know if it was her thesis. I think it was after she graduated. But yeah, Nicole Shanahan, who's RFK Jr.'s vice president, basically wrote some paper about quantitative easing through the use of carbon markets or something like that. It's been a while since I've read it.
Yeah, but basically this idea of how do we create more ability to create digital dollars, to create more dollars and spread this debt around, we have to place it somewhere. You know, you have to put it on the balance sheet somewhere. And so they are literally creating a green financial system that uses blockchain, that is upheld by satellites, that is upheld by regional agreements between, you know, 35 capital cities in Central and South America, to create a carbon credit trading, you know, system complete with one of the biggest markets in South America, Mercado Libre, to basically shove as much debt as possible, which is incredible to think of more dollar denominated debt being shoved on the global south, because that's where it all is, through IMF loans, World Bank loans, but more and more and more and more, you know, to basically be able to service the $34 trillion of runaway debt that the U.S. is at now. So they have to get creative to put this debt in other places.
Yeah. So Shanahan's project, it was after she graduated.
Oh, excuse me.
It was through like a part of Stanford called CodeX. The project is titled "An Analysis of Carbon Credit Markets as Validation for Climate Supportive Quantitative Easing Using the Blockchain." And it was specifically about creating a carbon coin that works in tandem with existing carbon markets. Very crazy. We'll leave that in the show notes for anyone that wants to read that. But pretty interesting, considering that we've had, there's been a lot of, Bitcoin specific rhetoric from RFK. I mean, he was one of the, I think, earliest presidential candidates to like openly endorse Bitcoin. But I think we can expect Trump to go in that same.
He's already doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I don't think he'll be, you know, the only main one for much longer. But I think, you know, it'll be interesting to watch that space in particular. Obviously, I'm a very guarded in my opinion on the whole Kennedy campaign right now, ever since the Gaza stuff, but and things that have happened since, obviously. But I think the Shanahan, pick is quite telling, and I mean, she, through her foundation, has some affiliations with the whole effective altruism crowd, and is the former, you know, wife of Sergey Brin, allegedly breaking up because she had a tryst with Elon Musk, which they both deny. And she says, actually, she was trying to look for solutions, she said, for her autistic daughter via Neuralink. And that was her reason for meeting with Musk. But either way, I mean, wanting to brain chip your autistic child, I just... definitely doesn't really seem like what they've been trying to market the Kennedy campaign as supporting in terms of health freedom and all of that. But anyway, don't want to get too into that.
And currently married to a former VP of Lightning Labs, which is a Jack Dorsey funded Bitcoin company that builds on the Lightning Network, which its main product is Taproot Assets, which is attempting to bring U.S. DT, which is Tether, dollar-denominated stablecoins, to Bitcoin. You know, that's literally what they're working on. Also, interestingly, Elizabeth Stark, the CEO, kind of infamously denied Epstein attempts at funding her product, through the MIT, kind of blockchain consortium there. Yeah, exactly. So kind of interesting that there was a big dollarization push directly funded or attempted to be funded by Epstein when she said no. Here we are, we got Dorsey and some other folks throwing money that way, so Reid Hoffman, some other people.
Well, we could definitely go on for a long time talking about all of this stuff, but I think we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there anything you'd like to wrap up with, Mark, before we go?
Just that I think it's really important to see what they're saying, because again, I think that they say a lot for whatever reason, karmic absolution, whatever it is, they like to say a lot of their plans in these little meetings that they have, these little side conference things and whatever, and say, you know, the quiet part out loud for sure. But also, you know, rhetoric is one thing and action is the other. So I think especially when navigating this world right now, it's really important to look at, you know, what they're saying, but take it with an iceberg of salt and really look at what their actions are. I think that's really important for where we're going next, because rhetoric is really the name of the game that they control discourse with. And we're in this crazy algo driven social media world, you know, where, you know, we have clips of presidential candidates with chainsaws and we're just in such clown world. And really look at what their rhetoric are, look at who they're surrounding themselves with, look at these companies that are being created and, you know, look at boards. Like, no one looks at VC stuff. So much of this project, this writing came about from us just like digging through, you know, who funded what. You know, we have 10,000 words of notes of literally just raw data of VC firms and seed funding. And I think that, you know, stuff like that, you know, it's all out there. There's so much available information, and just really like arm yourself with it. Don't fall for the rhetoric, because, you know, there's a whole new paradigm that's coming. And, you know, they want us to be as useful and as idiotic as possible. And I think we have to just be really skeptical of everything. And again, really thankful to be here. It's a pleasure to write with you and work with you. And I'm really thankful to be here on Unlimited Hangout once again. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And before signing off, I just want to piggyback on that. I mean, the amount of money and energy that's being directed into getting people to consent to this stuff is truly outrageous. I mean, if you think about it, all this effort in, you know, I don't want to say just Trump, but sort of like that political sphere in which he is enmeshed, there is an effort to manufacture consent among that particular the people they're trying to appeal to, their base, right? To give consent for digital ID, no anonymity online, all of these different agendas. And they're going to do it in all sorts of whatever ways. I mean, we already seen it with like the smart wall stuff. Obviously, the migration situation's out of control, but it's been out of control for a very long time. But there's been increased agitation about it. And the solution being offered is the smart wall. Which is, you know, a bipartisan spook-backed thing. So, I mean, it's going to be coming from either side, whichever side they think they can sell it most effectively, but they are selling it and they're going to go out of their way to sell it to people. But the fact that they're investing so much money in selling it means that they need to make people think that it's worth using. They need people to voluntarily onboard onto the system. And that is why they're putting so much money onto it. So what does that tell us? That tells us that if you don't comply or you don't use it, it will fail. And that, I think, is what they're most concerned about, going through all this effort. I mean, you see it with the carbon market, too. They've been trying to foist the carbon market on the world for a very long time. It's been very unsuccessful. It's been exposed time and time again as a giant grift palooza. But they're not disarming it or trying to, you know, it's not going anywhere. They're trying to find new ways to sell it to people, you know, even creating entire new like mini industries to try and prop it up. So I think that speaks a lot to like how much our willingness to comply or not comply is a factor in how far all of this stuff goes. So definitely appreciate you and your contributions to this project in order to help people see what's really going on here, at least, you know, the little pieces of the puzzle that we've been picking away at over the past several months. So thanks a lot, Mark. So where can people find your work and support you?
Definitely. Editor-in-chief of Bitcoin Magazine and author of The Bitcoin Dollar, which you can get at Bitcoin Magazine and some other big online marketplaces. Come check us out. I think we do some good work there. You can find me on Twitter at markgood_in.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much, Mark. And thanks everyone for listening, and especially everyone that supports this podcast. Thanks so much. Catch you all next time.